2 blocks from the White House and 12 blocks from the Capitol. The conference will include lectures, an awards banquet, a speaker's cocktail party, and, oh yes, a special luncheon presentation with yours truly. Come learn why, when it comes to UFOs, it's no longer just about lights in the sky. It's about lies on the ground. The National Press Club is just 2 blocks from Metro Center, and there are 24 hotels nearby. The event website, x-conference.com, that's x-conference.com, or call the Paradigm Research Group, 202-215-8344, that's 202-215-8344.
A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner. Good evening. Welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Good evening and welcome to this special edition of the Joyner Report, streaming live around the planet via the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, as well as broadcasting on WPRN-FM in New Orleans. I'd like to give a special shout out to our listeners in the Big Easy. I certainly appreciate y'all spending the evening with us. Additionally, you can listen to the show on your cell phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the station ID code 2899. I'm Frank Warren, returning as your guest host tonight while Angela is attending the UFO Symposium in Aztec, New Mexico. And for those of you in the Aztec area, she'll literally be speaking in about an hour or so. Also, you'll be pleased to know that Angela will be back in her chair next week with yet another intriguing guest that will be announced by Monday. As most of you are aware, I'm the publisher, editor, writer, and head cook and bottle washer of the UFO Chronicles, and I'm proud to acknowledge readers in over 150 countries. For the latest in UFO news, both past and present, you can find us at www.theufochronicles.com. One of the things that's unique to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on the Internet side is the fact that not only can you listen to the show, but you can participate in conversation in real time using the software known as PalTalk. I like to call it our virtual auditorium, or the V-Room, if you will. The software in question downloads in minutes, it's relatively easy to use, and enables you to posit questions to either myself or my guests. If you currently don't have PalTalk and you'd like to give it a try, you can Google it, or better yet, go to the UFO Chronicles, which again is at www.theufochronicles.com, and at the bottom of the article for tonight's show, you'll see the links to a step-by-step procedure of how to download the software and navigate to the room for this particular show. In Tingapeak in the V-Room, it looks like we've got another good crowd, and I know many of you are chomping at the bit to ask our guests some questions. And if you would, I'd like you to hold off just a bit, at least until we get a ways into the show. You'll know when. Now, for the benefit of our new listeners, the previous week's 2 shows focused on the UFO events of March 13, 1997, which collectively have become known as the Phoenix Lights. Tonight's show is going to be something similar in the sense that we're going to center on yet another well-known grandiose event in history, going back even further this time to the year of 1942. This UFO incident is known as the Battle of Los Angeles, and like the Phoenix Lights, it's one of the most significant occurrences regarding ufology as a whole. Tonight's special guest is not only a direct eyewitness to that event, but he's been a dear friend and colleague of mine for years. Moreover, he's also a partner in research for this specific incident, and I'm pleased to say that he's one of our columnists over at the UFO Chronicles as well, where you'll find his extensive exposés on his experience of February 25, 1942. Professor C. Scott Littleton, or Scotty as he prefers, has a very impressive professional and academic resume. His accolades and accomplishments are both abundant and widespread, and here are some of the highlights. Scotty was born in Los Angeles, California in 1933 and grew up in nearby Hermosa Beach. He attended Redondo Union High School in Redondo Beach from 46 to 50. we're now giving up his age, of course, and then served in the U.S. Army in Japan and Korea from 50 to 52. He attended El Camino College in Torrance from 52 to 54 before enrolling at UCLA in 1955, where he received his bachelor's and also was elected the Phi Beta Kappa in 57. He earned his master's in 1962 and his doctorate in 1965. Scotty is a recognized expert in comparative Indo-European mythology and folklore, as well as Japanese religion, and has written extensively on these topics, which include the origin and distribution of the Arthurian and Holy Grail legends and the theories of the late French mythologist Georges Dumézil. He is the author of a multitude of books on these subjects, as well as countless magazine articles. Scotty has done extensive field work in Tokyo in studying contemporary Japanese popular culture and is fluent in the language. Scotty's other research interests include 19th century travel accounts with Horace L. Hotchkiss. He's the co-editor of the diaries of Blakely Wilson, an American traveler in Europe, Egypt, and the Holy Land, 1874 through 1876, which was published by Mellon Press in 1998. And, of course, he's interested in the occult and paranormal phenomena with emphasis in ufology and alien abductions. The latter interest is reflected in his science fiction novel entitled Phase 2, published by Red Pill Press in 2009, which addresses alien abductions. He has also penned articles for UFO Magazine and has spoke ironically at the annual Aztec UFO Symposium back in 2006. His thesis, of course, was the Battle of Los Angeles. I might add that Scotty stood in for me during the Aztec Symposium back in 2006. He was asked on short notice. He was very well received, and he was just a big hit there. He has recently penned his memoir entitled 2500 Strand, Growing Up in Hermosa Beach, California during World War II, also published by Red Pill Press, in 2008, which of course includes a chapter devoted to the Battle of Los Angeles. He has received grants and fellowships from the American Council of Learned Societies twice, the American Philosophical Society, and the Winter Grin Foundation for Anthropological Research, and has served as a visiting Fulbright lecturer at the University of Tokyo and Waseda University 1980 through 81. In Tokyo, Japan, and as a senior Fulbright researcher at Waseda University 1994. In 1991, he received the Graham L. Sterling Memorial Award, given annually to a distinguished member of the Occidental College faculty. Scotty retired from full-time teaching at Occidental after 40 years in May of 2002, and currently lives with his lovely wife, Marianne, in Pasadena, California, where he continues to do research as well as write and is currently working on some new book projects. Believe it or not, those were just the highlights of his bio. I'm not kidding. To see his complete bio, just stop by the UFO Chronicles. It's currently at the top of the site. Scotty, welcome to the Joyner Report.
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this has been a long time coming. You and I chatted before we got on the air, and I really have been looking forward to this interview, as I know our listeners have. You know, in guesting for Angela on the Joyner Report, I have discovered that there is actually a phenomenon unto itself regarding the show. And what that phenomenon is, it seems that time accelerates while we're doing this show. So in that vein, why don't we just jump right into this thing and get this party started. What I'd like to do before we actually discuss the Battle of L.A. proper, for our younger listeners and those that might not be familiar with the history, I'd like to kind of paint the picture of the times, late 41, 42. You and I kind of touched on this before we went on the air. Of course, back in those days, America, we were pretty much a country of isolationists in the sense that we didn't want to get into Europe's war. Of course, the tension was building with Japan at that time. The majority of the American populace, I think it's safe to say, we weren't ready to get into this thing and didn't want to. Then, of course, December 7th, we have the tragedy and the horrific attack on Pearl Harbor, and that changed everything. During the months that followed Pearl Harbor, quickly with what was going on in terms of There was a rush to get the West Coast shored up in Western defenses, get gun batteries in place and operating and so forth and so on. And I know from our own personal research that was basically a process in action, you know, over the entire year 1942. But pretty much I think the feeling and I'm sure you would confirm this, I mean, basically after Pearl Harbor, the thinking was that a West Coast attack was imminent. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Yeah, we did. A lot of us were very nervous about the possibility that we would be attacked by the forces of Japan. In fact, for a time there, we thought almost every night that the Imperial Navy was just over the horizon. Remember, I lived at that point in Hermosa Beach. And we were trying to prepare for it. I mean, I'm talking broadly. I mean, my parents and I were too. But the whole of Santa Monica Bay was ringed with anti-aircraft batteries from Fort MacArthur on up to Malibu, and with searchlight batteries. The nearest searchlight battery to us was Manhattan Beach near the pier, but there were a lot of others. And by early late February, I'm sorry, it was still not. We were still losing the war. A lot of people don't realize. I mean, we were losing in, of course, the Philippines, Bataan, all of that. We were, and this was well before the Battle of Midway in May, when actually, in retrospect, the tide turned against Japan. But it was not clear at all at that point that we were going to win this thing. And we had also listened, my parents and I was 8 years old at this point, had listened only a year and a half earlier to broadcasts from London, the very famous broadcast of Edward R. Murrow saying, "This is London," and the bombs going off behind him. We knew all about the Blitz, and it was recent history, and we just were wondering when if it was going to be our turn, because, I mean, we were on the front line there as far as Japan. I mean, you don't go any further west than Hermosa Beach unless you get into the water. So, yeah, you're correct. There was this sense of a nervousness about whether, if or when, we would be attacked.
Now, aside from the nervousness, the preparation was going on. There were air raid drills, and in fact, right out in front of your house there, didn't they practice target shooting and pull a target behind a plane?
Yes.
Could you explain that?
Beginning in late December, after they got the gun emplacements in, which was quite quick, not every night, but maybe every third night or so, the gunners would practice, and they would practice shooting at targets by planes way out over the Pacific. We had a grandstand seat to this. I remember the kids in the neighborhood at first, when they first started doing this, we were, you know, it's exciting. This is the war, you know. And we watched, this is real. We watched them, the searchlights would pinpoint the drone. This would be way out to sea now, because they didn't want short rounds falling on the civilians. And they would fire maybe for half an hour or so, and we'd watch the shells explode. Quite often, or more often than not, hit the drone, and they were practicing, and that made us feel like, hey, our brave gunners are going to protect us from the Imperial Japanese fleet and Air Force. So, we were used to this. We also had blackouts quite frequently. We had blackout drills. My father was an air raid warden, and he usually got a phone call saying that a blackout was coming and a drill was coming. This is a drill. And then he would get his gear on and go out and make sure, particularly along the Strand. Mm-hmm. We lived, this is kind of important for what we're going to talk about. We lived, if any of your audience knows Southern California in general and Hermosa Beach in particular, we lived at 2500 Strand, which is the title of the memoir that Frank kindly mentioned a few minutes ago. 2500 Strand, and right on the ocean, looking out to the beach and then out over the water. And the particularly important were the lights that shone out over the water, because they, of course, would be prime, would give everything away.
Scotty, so you would explain the definition of strand for our listeners.
Okay, the strand, yeah, it's the walkway and bikeway today that runs the whole length of Hermosa Beach, really, actually, from Manhattan Beach down to Redondo. In Hermosa, it's called the Strand. Mm-hmm. And it's not for automobiles. Again, it's for walk. It's for walking, for bikes, for skate, inline skaters, etc. So in our house, the fronted on this. And well, behind it was Hermosa Avenue, where the garage was.
And I should say, we do have a photograph of your old home that are embedded in your articles. Anybody that's listening to the show on the internet, you can see his articles. There are links to the articles at the top of the article announcing tonight's show. And if you click on one of those links, you can actually go to the first part one and part two of those articles, and a photograph of Scotty's home, a recent photograph taken there on the Strand, for anybody interested who wants to see that picture. That photograph also is in your new book, 2500 Strand.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have in the book, luckily I inherited a photograph of it as it looked in 1941.
Yes.
The year we moved there, so you, the reader can see exactly where I stood, what it looked like at that point a year later. And then there is a photograph, I'm not sure, I can't remember, but in the book, certainly a photograph of what the house looks like today. And it's different, but basically the same house. It's 100 years old this year. The house was built in 1910.
And a beautiful house. Beautiful house it is. I love that place.
Okay. And it's probably more beautiful than ever today.
Would it be safe to say that, now this is something that in our research together and whatnot, I always go back to the target practice that they did. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they were using the guns that were in place, so those were 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds, with the exception of the guns that were at Fort MacArthur with 5-inch anti-aircraft rounds.
Yeah.
But is it safe to say that they, with all the target practice that they did, that the defense units that were involved in that were proficient in their shooting? I mean, you mentioned that they did hit.
I'm losing you.
I can hear you, Scotty. Go ahead.
Okay, I lost you for a second. Sorry. We could see them occasionally get a hit. And the drone would go down. But you have to realize that for the first few times they did this in late December, they, are you here?
Yes.
Okay, good. In late December, we were excited. We watched it and you know, oh boy, look what's going. But like everything else, it routinized very quickly. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of weeks, it was almost, we would hear the guns at night. And we'd say, oh, they're firing tonight. We'd almost like the sound of the surf, right? I mean, it was just part of the ambient noise of living at the beach. And also occasionally we would hear military planes going overhead. There were no civilians. Civilian pilots were totally grounded on December 8th, I think.
How big was the dig? This is going to, I'm going to make a point later on in our conversation, but how big would you guesstimate the drone to be?
Oh, maybe. Oh, God, it's hard to tell. That's a question I never really thought about.
In reference to the plane pulling it,
probably a little bigger. I'd say maybe 30 feet, something like that, 20 feet. But remember, it's way out to sea. It's not right overhead. It's way out to sea, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and you didn't get a really good view. We could see the searchlights pinpointing it and see the rounds exploding, but it
Well, yeah, in contrast to the plane pulling it, how long would you say it would? I mean, just give rough dimensions.
Oh, rough dimensions. Well, I'd say maybe 20 feet. I don't know. Here again, I have to stop and think. I've never really considered this. Maybe 25 feet. 20. I may be off.
25 and a good distance out to sea when they were used to practice.
Maybe a mile, a mile, 2 miles.
Okay. Yeah. This I bring that up because we're going to address.
I know why you're bringing it up, but yes. I just never thought about it. Yeah.
So to reemphasize, Pearl Harbor had just taken place.
A
few months previously.
Yes.
The flavor of the times is that an attack on the West Coast is imminent. If the Japanese were crazy enough to do what they did at Pearl Harbor, in terms of the mechanics of the war and whatnot, the next obvious step would be to attack the West Coast. So that was pretty much a given at the time. Everybody's a little tense. Everybody's in war mode. There's target practice going on. There's blackouts. The blackouts are tested. And people, by the way, in these blackouts, of course, when they did these at night, you had to close all your windows. You had blackout curtains. Is that correct?
Right.
You couldn't have any headlights on if you were not the few people that actually were given passes to drive, like either the military and or the media, that kind of thing.
Yeah, or on dim, and you know, I mean, yeah, and the lights, for example, on the line, the strand, that would be turned off, of course.
Right.
And later in the war, I might add, they had what is called the dim out, which is a little different. Where you every night, until 43 practically, we had to keep all of the windows that faced the ocean, the curtains had to be tight, and the lights on the strand would only have a little square on the landward side of the lamppost. And that was to prevent silhouetting oil tankers like those that would be coming into El Segundo against submarines. So the dim out that persisted for much longer.
Certainly,
but they were already doing that. They were already doing that then. But we're talking about straight blackouts. You know, every light out.
In short, the tension was extremely high.
Yeah.
And now, of course, there was actually an event that occurred in 41, but I won't go into a lot of detail about that, with the exception to say that aircraft had come in, and unknown aircraft, and, well, to use the term in the verbatim, UFOs were tracked up by the Golden Gate Bridge, rather, up in San Francisco. But on the 23rd of February, what some thought was a prelude to invasion, something happened at Elwood, and could you explain what happened there?
Well, Elwood, is an oil installation just north of Goleta, which again is north of Santa Barbara, some 100 miles north of Los Angeles. And a Japanese submarine surfaced and shelled this oil installations, the refinery installations up there, and did some damage, and then, of course, went submerged and went on its way. But that shook up the country because at that point, it was the first time the continental United States had been bombarded from the sea since the War of 1812.
And right,
that was a little spooky. Yeah, although in retrospect, that was the precursor for a massive invasion, even at the time, a lot of us were, you know, what, one submarine deck gun, you know. But it did shake people up. Yeah, it meant that they were out there and they meant business.
And that, by the way, that was the Barnsdall Oil Company at Elwood.
Right.
And for the most part, although 13 rounds were fired there, there really wasn't a whole lot of damage. It was
not a lot.
A little bit. No, it wasn't too big of a deal. However,
it was enough to inert people.
Exactly. The psychological impact was significant. Now, we know in retrospect that that particular sub was the I-17, and it was, in fact, an aircraft-carrying sub. It was an aircraft carrier. And the I-17s, by the way, were some of the, well, they were actually the largest submarines of the day. The Japanese had the largest submarines, and they had the only submarines that were had the ability to carry aircraft and were aircraft carriers. The aircraft carriers, in fact, carried a plane that we, our code name for it was called the Glenn, and it was a little, I want to say it was a biplane. I forget exactly off the cuff, but it was a very small plane.
I think it was a biplane.
They would launch it off the deck. It had its own compartment. They were a submarine.
The wings folded, I believe.
It completely folded up. The submarine would surface, and then they would do a catapult launch. And on its return, it was a float plane, so it would land on the water, and then they would capture it and then take
it back in
and put it back in. Now, we know in retrospect that the I-17 at that time was not carrying a Glenn, and we know that because we have information from the captain and some of the crew members of that particular submarine. I raise this because in the aftermath of the Battle of Los Angeles, some of the speculation was, in fact, that it might have been a Glenn plane, which did, by the way, there was a Glenn plane did fly and drop a bomb up in Oregon sometime later. I don't know if that was in 42 or not, but that actually did, in fact, happen. But it did not happen in this particular instance there. So now we have to paint the flavor, and I can't reemphasize it enough. The tension is at an all-time high. An attack is basically thought to be imminent on the West Coast. Then we have the submarine lobbing shells at the oil refinery, which was thought to be a precursor to an attack on the West Coast. And then on the 24th. On the old SCR 268, the Navy picked up and I use this term in the vernacular of the layman, picked up a UFO about 125 miles off the coast. Subsequently, two SCR 270s in different areas confirmed what the SCR 268 radar. The 268 radar, by the way, for our listeners, that was the same radar setup that detected the B-25s coming in to Oahu prior or the same day of the Pearl Harbor attack. And it was some of the early radar systems of the day. But the point being is that three individual radar stations picked up this UFO 125 miles off the coast. Moving inland. I'll let you describe the events from that point, Scotty.
Well, yeah, there is the evidence they picked up these objects coming in, and they were coming in from the north, the northwest. They were coming in basically over probably Port Hueneme, down over the Malibu, the Malibu Mountains, and they were picked up by observers coming over the Pacific Palisades, and particularly and in Santa Monica. They or it, and there's a big controversy over whether it was they or it. The one thing I can say, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, is that I only saw one object. I did not see a fleet. I did not see a formation. I saw a single object. And I must add, and I think, Frank, you'll agree, that the great majority of eyewitnesses whose accounts we've gotten talk about a single object. Am I correct?
That's absolutely right.
Yes. A single. But I am willing to open to the possibility that there might have been at least one other object. I mean, anomalous object. There were planes in the sky, even though the government says they weren't. There were. I saw them. But that another anomalous object might have followed a slightly different track. We can get to that later.
We should probably take this opportunity to say that you and I have been researching this for a few years now, and of course the research is ongoing. Mm-hmm. And we are, of course, open to other theories in terms of multiple UFOs or more than just the large craft. I think it's safe to say one of the things that's always been a bone of contention, of course, after the event, and I'm getting a little off track, too. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. But the next day, of course, there was a lot of confusion between the powers that be in terms of what exactly happened.
The Army and the Navy, to be exact.
Yeah, they were butting heads. Knox with the Navy and Stimson with the Army. But before we get into the next day, we have the event that came up from the north and is coming down the coast. Then what happens?
Well, it doesn't immediately come down the coast. It goes a bit inland, over Hollywood, over West Hollywood, over and down toward Culver City. It's too bad this isn't television. I could inscribe a map here. Over and down toward the Baldwin Hills. Mm-hmm. And it lifted over the Baldwin Hills, probably just east of where La Cienega goes over, the La Cienega Boulevard goes over the Baldwin Hills, that separate Culver City, et cetera, from Inglewood. Once it got over the Baldwin Hills, it seemed to have veered to the west, over the western part of Inglewood, and particularly over El Segundo. Mm-hmm. And that's significant. It's one of the reasons, by the way, why some people thought it might have been a Japanese plane, because El Segundo was the location of, was the focal point of the aircraft industry, one of them, Long Beach being another. Douglas, North American, Lockheed, they were all there in El Segundo at that point. I know that because my mother was Rosie the Riveter. She worked at Douglas, riveting wingtips for the pose for the famous picture. But anyway, so it goes over the aircraft plants and reaches the coast off of El Segundo, about where the sewer outlet is, I guess, and then starts heading down the edge of the water, heading south. It veers south, down past Hyperion, past where the sewer outlet is, south of El Segundo, into El Porto, over Manhattan Beach, again following the edge of the ocean. Mm-hmm. That much seems clear, to where we saw it in Hermosa Beach at about 3:30 or thereabouts in the morning. Now, we probably do you want to get into that context now about what happened and how we went out there?
Before we get into that, I think it's important to note as far as the flight path is concerned, mm-hmm. you and I collectively put together mm-hmm. Dozens of eyewitness reports and newspaper mm-hmm. reports, and this basically gave us different positions at different times.
That's right.
And this is how we were able to map this. I'm actually looking at the period map. Now, of course, I dug up a period map ages ago.
It passed along to me. Thank you.
And we took these the reports of the time, and we were able to get a particular flight path. Now, that, mm-hmm. that map, by the way, we do have in your article that mm-hmm. is linked to it over at the UFO Chronicles. And I think part of the other interesting things, in addition to the flight path of these reports, people were describing an elliptical-shaped object, silver in color, right. A blimp-like was one term used. Mm-hmm. This thing was anything but a conventional plane. It was moving very slowly.
Oh, very slowly.
Down the coast.
It even hovered, I'm convinced. That once just about the point where I saw it, right in front of the house that we mentioned earlier, my mother and I looked up almost directly overhead, because the beach then was about half or less the width that it is today. It was a fairly narrow beach, and it was at the end. We were looking almost straight up, and what we didn't see any configuration. My guess is it was somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 feet. This is way after the fact. Up, we saw an elliptical lozenge shape. My mother always called it a bug, a silver bug up there, pinpointed in the searchlight beams, and with shells of anti-aircraft rounds exploding all around it, but not hitting it. It seemed to be oblivious to them. And it hovered a little bit and then slowly began moving south again for a ways, and then began to cut inland. We are again at this slow speed, but began also to slightly lose altitude. We lost sight of it over Redondo Beach, what had to be looking south. And so it didn't go straight south over the Palos Verdes Hills. It veered inland. It did go over the Palos Verdes Hills, obviously, but much further east.
Well, inland. Scotty, let me pause you just for a second, and sure. I think this is kind of a neat story for our listeners. Well, first off, you're 8 years old.
I'm 8 years old, yeah.
Many of our listeners are probably wondering what you were doing outside in the middle of an air raid while this was going on. Why don't you explain the...
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm saying. I'll pinpoint what happened. About 3 o'clock, a little after three, I went to bed that night, all around my usual 10 o'clock, 9:30, bedtime. And I had a house on the second floor of that house that looked kind of obliquely out over the water. And as I recall, there had been some practice rounds fired. We heard the guns. Didn't bother at that point. We didn't bother to look out. We heard the guns fire a few rounds, maybe about 9 o'clock. I might add that they rarely practice much past 9:30 or 10 in deference to the civilian people that wanted to sleep. I mean, the aircraft workers, right? They wanted them alert. So the defense workers. But in any event, there had been a few rounds fired. Didn't pay any attention to it. I went to bed. I read a little bit with a flashlight, probably a comic book or whatever, that I kept hidden under my pillow, and I'd say about 10:15 or so, I turned out the light and went to sleep. I was awakened. This is something that, by the way, that has occurred to me recently, and since probably the last time you and I have talked about it. What woke me up a little after 3 o'clock was not the sound of the guns. I remembered this now. I brought this up in my... I dredged this up from my old aging subconscious. What woke me up was the sound of piston-driven airplanes, aircraft. Now, we were familiar with that. I mean, obviously, I mean, a piston-driven, nor any jets. A flight of planes going almost over the house and heading, the best I could figure, off to the southeast a little bit. By the time I got out of bed, bleary-eyed, and looked out the window, they were gone from view. But these were clearly piston-driven planes.
So from your point of view, you think you're in the middle of an attack.
Well, we heard these planes, but we didn't. I didn't hear the guns. They hadn't really started firing. The planes were going overhead then. So I get back in bed and I doze for maybe a couple of minutes, and then suddenly, excuse me, pardon me. Then I hear what sounded at first like thunder. But very quickly, I realized there the guns are going. Well, I look at the clock. It's now about 3:15, a little after, about 3:15, 3:16, the clock by my bed. And what are the guns doing firing at this hour? And not only were they firing, but the explosion, the shell explosions, everything seemed much closer. I looked out the window, and here were searchlight beams very close at hand. I mean, they were practically right overhead. And I look out the window. I see flashes. I see – I'm awfully sorry. I've got a frog in my throat. I see the flashes of exploding shells. At that point, I couldn't see the object, but I could see the flashes, and I could see searchlight beams sort of moving a little bit toward the south. And so I popped my head out the door, and I heard my parents talking excitedly, nervously in the hallway. And we had living with us my maternal, my mother's father, a recently widowed old elderly gentleman, and my paternal grandparents, my father's, my grandfather Littleton and grandmother Littleton. And it was a pretty large house. And so my father looked very worried, and the thing that's interesting in one little sidelight is that you would think that he would have gotten a phone call from the civil defense, local civil defense people, but
He was an air raid warden.
The whole system, yeah, exactly. Remember I said the whole system broke down, and he heard the gun, something's going on, so he ran outside. He put on his gear, grabbed his helmet and his pack and his billy club and he carried, and they ran outside, looked around and came back upstairs and said, look, I think this could be the real thing. And he said there would have to be a blackout, even though he hadn't been told there was. We hadn't even heard a siren. They had an air raid siren fairly near it. We didn't hear the siren till right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. Other places, the civil defense worked, but in the South Bay area, certainly in our area, it didn't. Everything fell apart. There was some discussion about that later. But anyway, he got out, and he said, everybody down to the bomb shelter. Now, in beginning the afternoon of Pearl Harbor in December 7th, my father, in fact, he happened to be down at the local Safeway market in the morning of Sunday, December 7th, when he got the news. And the first thing he did was grab every carton he could and throw them in the back seat of our old 39 Mercury, came home, and my mother and I filled those cartons with beach sand, and we dragged them in the little door into the basement that surrounded a set of dressing rooms. This was a beach house. It was a second home. My parents, my grandparents had lived in Pasadena, but they built this as a beach house in 1910, and it had been remodeled. But there were a couple of dressing rooms on the ground. It was three stories in the front and two in the back, and open basement on either side. And so we dragged the cartons in and piled them up against the wall. And we were building a bomb shelter. Mm-hmm. Same, and it was restocked it with some water, bottles of water, and some canned food, and so on. And this time we hadn't used it, of course, since it had been built. But I remember my father said to my get everybody down to the bomb shelter, and my grandfather Hotchkiss. It's a funny little story. My mother's maiden name was Hotchkiss. Was extremely slow, as my mother, even my mother used to say, her father was slower than the second coming of Christ in his habits. But that night, I remember my father saying, I'll never forget this, Mr. Hotchkiss, I think this is the real thing. You better get down to the bomb shelter. And he was dressed and down there in 30 seconds flat. Boom. Anyway, so the older generation went down there, and my mother went down. But after about a few seconds in there, she said the closeness, these were tiny little rooms, little dressing room. She said she was ready to brave a Japanese bomb or two compared to the halitosis of the older generation. So she goes to this little door that led directly out to the strand or to the beach, see, a door at the basement of the house. That door is very visible in the picture, yes. If you look at it online. And so when my father remembers out defending, the blackout and making sure that it out on the strand, the walkway, and enforcing the blackout, getting people off the street and so on. But my mother starts out that door. She wanted to see what was going on, and I did too. I mean, I was scared, but intensely curious. I wanted to see the real thing too, right. So I skittle out behind her, and she let me, she she said later she felt she probably should have made me go back in, but she could understand how curious I was. I wanted to see what was going on. We both did. So we stood together, and even though conceivably it could have been dangerous if the bombs had started to fall, I suppose we'd have ducked back in. But we huddled together. It was chilly. This is about 3:30, 3:25, 3:30 by this time in the morning. In a very clear night, cold, chilly, but clear. No clouds in the sky. And we looked almost directly overhead, and here is the bug that she called, the silvery bug, the lozenge, caught in the searchlights, but with a glow all its own. It was clear that it was glowing in addition to the illumination of the searchlights. And I swear it was hovering for a few seconds, for almost the better part of a minute.
Now, Scotty, let me pause you just for a second.
Sure.
It's speculation on my part, but there were many reports where witnesses thought that in addition to the silvery color, they said that they thought that there was a red glow to this. Now, I know. Well, my thinking was, of course, you had the three inch anti-aircraft rounds exploding around that. So, and other people had described the thing as fireworks going off. You know, it was the 4th of July with so many bombs exploding around this huge UFO. I attributed some of the color to the shell burst. But what you're saying is that, in addition and or separate from that, that this thing had its own color.
Yeah, but it was a white glow. It wasn't color.
Okay.
I do know that several witnesses, a woman that we both know in Baldwin Hills named Katie, who saw a clear red glow on the ventral side of it.
She actually said orange, but close enough.
Orange, orangey red. And
Katie, her report is actually public, so we can say that she resided at the Baldwin Hills.
Yeah, that's right. And she was in the Baldwin. There were several other witnesses in the same general area in Culver City, a mile or so further north. But nevertheless, they saw a glow. I did not see any color. I saw a brilliant glowing white silver glow, but it was clearly glowing in addition to being illuminated. I don't remember even that the shell explosions were casting red shadows on. I saw this glowing thing and then sort of surrounded by shell bursts, some of them quite close, but it ignored them. And then it picked up after we stood there for a few seconds. It started moving again south. Continuing south, and as I said,
I'm going to make my point that I was alluding to when we began.
Sure.
Now, when we started the show, we were talking about the target practice that you witnessed often when they were pulling the target behind the plane. You're guesstimating the size of that target to be about 30 feet. They were 30. A couple miles offshore, and they were proficient in the target practice in the sense that they hit the target. Correct?
Well, I think I saw him hit it once or twice. Well, half the time we didn't even look.
Well, a 30-foot target, I mean, they were close and they were hitting it periodically.
Yeah, but I remember later, the next day after this event, several people, I remember neighbors were saying, boy, these guys better sharpen up. They can't, these gunners must be awful, you know.
Because
they can't hit the side of a barn door. Well, I think they did hit the barn door, it just they couldn't blow it up.
Well, now here's my point. Now, I've done several exclusives, and we've had some what we call at the UFO Chronicles breaking news that we've actually announced here on the Joiner Report. And I'm going to keep in that same vein in the sense that you and I have kind of kept close to our chest just where the infamous photo that donned the L.A. Times the next day of the nine searchlight beams encapsulating the elliptical-shaped UFO, which, by the way, of course, I found that negative years ago and introduced it to the Internet. We now, I'm comfortable with saying that we determined through our research, yours and mine, that photograph was taken over the Baldwin Hills.
That's right, from now, the north.
Additionally,
as it lifted south over the hill.
The bulk of the reports, and this is important, and this is my point. With all the collected reports, the main theme was that this object, the huge UFO, was at approximately 8,000 feet. Now, we know that varied depending from time to time, but the consensus was it was at 8,000 feet. Now, I bring this up because if you notice in the for our listeners that are familiar with the infamous photo of the Battle of Los Angeles, you'll notice that some of the beams exactly encompass the UFO edge to edge. Now, we further identified that because you and I have sliced and diced up the photograph and have done in-depth photo analysis to this thing. Now, again, with our research, we know exactly what searchlights were being used.
The most important one is the one coming in from the right.
Well, my point is that we know the configuration. We know the beam divergence of these things, the degrees. We know the location of the gun batteries and the searchlight batteries. And what I did is I took that information, I took all the mathematical factors, and I handed that over to Dr. Bruce McAbee, who, for our regular listeners know, was our guest last Friday night, last week's show. And he came back, as brilliant as he is, he came back using his mathematical skills and came up with an estimate of how wide this UFO was. Now, according to his, according to the math, now bear in mind, these factors were going with rough estimates based on eyewitness reports. You know, these can vary by a substantial degree. But if they were close, according to the math, the object was over 800 foot wide.
Eight feet wide.
So the question, now bear in mind, we did have the United States Navy did have the USS Macon and the Akron, the USS Akron, which were dirigibles of the day that were about 1,000 feet long. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, and of course a dirigible, which we used helium in those days, one 3-inch anti-aircraft round would take a dirigible, helium-filled dirigible down, just like that.
Absolutely. There's no way it could have been a dirigible.
So the question is, what in 1942 is silver in color, elliptical shaped, over 800 foot long, and can withstand 3-inch anti-aircraft round for several hours?
Answer, nothing.
Nothing then and nothing today, I might add.
Nothing today. Yeah, well, I don't know whether you want to get into this now, but I'm convinced that way after the fact that it was surrounded by a field, by an EMF, by an electromagnetic field, that in effect shielded it from the exploding shells, or at least most of them. That it may, I still think we might, somehow the shield might have failed and we might have wounded it, let's get into that later. But nevertheless, it was blithely ignoring everything we were throwing at it, at least when I saw it.
One of the reasons that I brought the size up is because here we have the powers that be, our defense resources, doing target practice with what you guesstimate as a 30-foot target, and they hit it periodically. One of the notions in the
aftermath.
As you mentioned earlier, some people argued, well, my God, they couldn't hit this thing. Well,
yes.
If the math is correct, if all these estimates are correct, this thing was huge. It was huge. And the very picture, you can see that the 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds, in my view, are actually hitting the object or very close to it.
Yes. And same with what I saw.
Yeah, it goes back to your the glow that you saw around it, and I am very open to the notion that this thing may have had some sort of shielding that we're not aware of.
I go further than that, Frank. I'm morally convinced of it.
Yes.
It had to. I think it had to had a shield. Had to have had a shield, a force field around it.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes to the break, Scotty, and we'll get into a whole bunch of that on the other side. So basically, now you're out front with your mother. We'll take this out to the break. You're huddled by her. The shell is beginning. The searchlight beams are like fingers in the sky, scanning the sky.
And the shrapnel is hitting the beach.
You are actually either fleeing or seeing the shrapnel.
Yeah, shrapnel hits the beach. And we kids, the next day, next couple of days, the local kids picked up a lot of it and hauled it on a wagon up to the our school and gave it to the scrap drive.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We're patriotic. It was recycled.
I might add that, unfortunately, that night we did lose lives.
Yes, we did.
Some people, because of the fact that they presumed that an attack was going on, people had heart attacks. Some people were hurt by falling shrapnel.
There was a couple of car wrecks.
Yeah.
And I have a witness I know that's watched a piece, saw in over Long Beach, a piece of shrapnel crash through his neighbor's garage at the roof.
Well, Scotty, we're coming to the top of the hour here, so we're going to have to take a break. Boy, this is getting good. And for our listeners, you're listening to the Joiner Report at the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, WPR on FM in New Orleans, and we'll see you on the other side.
Banquet, a speaker's cocktail party, and oh yes, a special luncheon presentation with yours truly. Come learn why, when it comes to UFOs, it's no longer just about lights in the sky. It's about lies on the ground. The National Press Club is just 2 blocks from Metro Center, and there are 24 hotels nearby. The event website, x-conference.com, that's x-conference.com, or call the Paradigm Research Group, 202-215-8344, that's 202-215-8344.
Good evening, and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joiner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joiner.
Welcome back to the Joiner Report. I'm your guest host tonight, Frank Warren, sitting in for Angela while she's speaking at the Aztec UFO Symposium. You are listening. If you're listening to us on the Internet, of course, we are at the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we're broadcasting live at WPRN-FM in New Orleans. My guest tonight is a very dear friend of mine, as well as research colleague, Scotty Littleton. And, Scotty, welcome back on the other side of the Joiner Report.
Okay. I'm here.
Why don't we just, let's start right back where we left off. You were telling our audience that you're standing outside with your mother. In essence, you're thinking that this is a Japanese attack happening.
Well, that was the first thought. Yeah, everybody not only that night, but for the next day, that it was a Japanese observation plane, maybe off of a carrier, and that they were out spotting the terrain and that the Imperial Fleet might be coming over the horizon the next morning.
Right.
A carrier force. So that was the first thought. It was a Japanese plane. But it was the obvious interpretation given the time and the place. But it certainly didn't act like an airplane. Airplanes aren't large that we ever, no airplane that we had ever seen was a large, obviously large, even at 8,000 feet, lozenge shaped. Bug-shaped, as my mother called it, glowing object that moved so slowly. The only thing that could move that slowly, I suppose, would be a blimp.
Mm-hmm.
But no blimp could have withstood the barrage.
So, those were some of the descriptions. It was described as blimp-like in shape, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
sure.
That would be a point of reference. I mean, nobody was thinking of disc-shaped UFOs in those days.
But to get back to your personal sighting, you're now outside your front door on the strand with your mother.
Huddling up against the wall because the shrapnel was falling It didn't come very close to us, but we saw some fall on the beach, 50 yards away. So we kind of backed up against the wall and watched this thing open mouth. I mean, what in the hell is going on up there? Well, we watched it go again, start moving again. It only hovered for a few, seemed like forever, but it probably was less than 30 seconds. But I swear it was standing. Then it began to move again, slowly, 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 to the south, toward in the direction of the Palos Verdes Peninsula. But well before it got there, it veered slowly inland and began to lose altitude. That much I do know. Mm-hmm. It began to lose altitude as it headed over what was Redondo Beach. And it passed out of our field of vision. Well, we still stood there and wondered what was going on. We heard the guns, the searchlights were still going, the explosions, etc. But we could no longer see the object.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I've got one question from the virtual auditorium, and I'll go ahead and take this. It's a little off this specific instance in terms of your sighting, but Southern Star is asking if there are any more photographs, and I'll give the answer to that. The answer is, in fact, yes. There are other photographs. They are not currently in the public domain, and there's more going on with that will come out as time goes on. Bear in mind, this particular case is, in fact, ongoing. In regards to the altitude, when this went over your house, Scotty, what do you think the altitude was at that point in time?
I'm pushing my aging brain to the max here. I would guess probably somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 feet, more like closer to 8. Mm-hmm. But then it dropped. By the time we lost sight of it, it was definitely at least 4,000 or lower.
Mm-hmm.
But when it was overhead, we really didn't see it. My mother and I didn't see it come down the coast from the direction of Manhattan Beach. Obviously, it did. Other people saw it. But by the time we came out the door, it was practically overhead. I also
a couple other questions from our group in the V room, Scotty. We have I don't want to miss anybody. I was derelict in duty last week with our V room, so I want to pay special attention to our group there. The good majority is with us every week, and we certainly appreciate that. One question from Instant Karma. Were you aware of any other Army photographers there at the time? I think I know the answer to that based on research.
Oh, no. And in fact, in retrospect, I mean, people didn't carry cameras around then like they do today.
Right.
I wish I had had a camera. I wish I had had a video recorder. Of course, they wouldn't be invented for decades.
Well, photographer,
I didn't see any photographers. No.
Well, to the photograph, we can say that the photograph was taken by a speed graphic of the day. That was the common tool for print photographers of the various newspapers. So, and we know that to be certain.
But they didn't take them anywhere I was.
Right. This particular question is from Broomstacker, and he asked, does Scott feel that the shells were hitting the object with no effect, or were they being deflected? Now, you spoke to this just a little bit earlier.
I think they were exploding around it. In other words, deflected would be the best answer. But we didn't see them bouncing off. They would get to a certain point, explode, but not hit it. It would keep moving. You see what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, most certainly. Most certainly. And here's a very interesting question from Antos 3. He makes a point and asks a question. He writes, explosions from the anti-aircraft fire produce concussive forces, which push aircraft. Did the UFO shudder during the fire? That is a great question.
It's an interesting question. My answer, let me take a nanosecond to think about it. No. I saw no effect at all. I didn't see it vibrate or anything. It just kept moving slowly. Well, first it was sitting there. Yeah. Boom, 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 boom. The stuff is going on around it. And then it starts moving. More shells, more nothing. Just keeps moving. Very steady, going its stately way down along the edge of the water.
Yes.
Heading south.
Well, and, you know, to a little more emphasis on that question, I'm not aware of any other reports, and boy, I have really culled many that suggest that there was any type of movement from the concussion of the glass. That was a really good question.
It's a good question, but my answer would be none that I observed.
Yeah, exactly.
Or I remember. Yeah.
I think what we'll do... We've got a rare treat for our listeners tonight. If we can pull this off, we actually have the CBS radio report. Now we experimented with this before we went on the air, and it seemed to work properly. So for our listeners around the world and in New Orleans and in the V Room, we're now going to play the actual CBS News broadcast. Regarding the Battle of L.A. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a try. This is going to last a couple of minutes, and then we'll pick it up on the other side of this. So here we go.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 6 a.m. Pacific war time. The anti-aircraft guns began talking during a scout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly to the coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles, far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they could see the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th. Already, it was alert to the presence off the Southern California coast of a Japanese submarine, which had pumped 25 shells into an oil field north of Santa Barbara Monday evening. Because of the presence of the submarine, a three-hour alert was ordered at dusk last night, and civilian authorities stood at their post while the Army and Navy continued their search for the submersible. The evening alert ended at 10:23 p.m., but another was at 2:22 a.m., and the blackout followed within 3 minutes. It covered Los Angeles County from Santa Monica to Pomona. At 2:27, all Southern California radio stations were ordered off the air, except those in San Diego. Approximately 20 minutes after the firing died down, the ship returned and headed westward from Long Beach toward Santa Monica. The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could see the concussion of the guns more clearly, and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean. We return you now to CBS in New York.
And that was Byron Palmer on the West Coast.
Wow. That just kind of takes you back and puts you there, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Well, there are some serious implications in that report, as you know. The idea that of the second barrage is interesting. It may well have occurred, but it wasn't over us. And I have my own thought of, if I may, I have my own thought here.
Sir?
I think we may be talking about two separate objects. I've only recently come to this conclusion after listening to that report and looking at some newspaper accounts. What intrigues me is the mention of the city of Huntington Park and in some other reports of Downey, but particularly Huntington Park. Initially, I assumed that this was a mistake and that they meant, that whoever wrote that piece meant Huntington Beach, which is south of Long Beach. In other words, as the craft went down the coast. But Huntington Park is well inland. It's not to be confused with Huntington Beach. And there, I found Huntington Beach surfacing in several other reports. Huntington Park, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and the notion that there was also firing and searchlights over this area, excuse me, southeast of Los Angeles. And so, I'm wondering if there might not have been another object that somehow did reverse course and move north again or northeast. And there are rumors, there are some reports of an anomalous object that night, excuse me, sorry, that impacted somewhere in the San Bernardino Mountains. Whereas the object we saw, the large object, my hunch is, gut level hunch is that this would have been a smaller object, although we have, as far as I know, Frank, no eyewitnesses of this for this second craft.
No.
We have, right?
We do not, no. But I am certainly, you and I have talked about this, and I am open to that idea, and I think it needs to be pursued.
I mean, I know what I saw. I'm just saying that there, I have no personal knowledge of this, excuse me, this second, possible second craft, but it's not impossible that it was there and that it followed a rather different trajectory, both coming from the north, northwest.
I might, let me also point out, that remember, I'd like our listeners to just remember that we were just attacked at Pearl Harbor. We were spanked. We were caught with our pants down. The notion that we did not send planes up in this event, which was thought to be an attack by the Japanese with a submarine launching, lobbing shells within 48 hours earlier is ludicrous. Certainly our planes were up. You and I have cold witnesses that have substantiated that have actually seen our planes in the air. That CBS report states that our own planes were in the air.
And I can confirm that. If you want me to pick up a little bit further, after we lost sight of the object and as the firing died down, it lingered past 3:30. That report says it stopped at 3:30. I would say it was more like 3:40 or closer to 3:45. But around 3:45, as we stood there, still kind of transfixed, a flight of interceptors, a flight of planes came from the north. At least we could see them. Went practically over our house and to the southeast, and it was clear they were chasing it. They were going and following the same direction.
Now, to reiterate, I think this is very important, and
yes.
I want to make sure our listeners understand what you just said. Scotty Littleton, a direct eyewitness to the Battle of Los Angeles, February 24th, 25th, 1942. You, in fact, with your own eyes, saw our own planes chasing this UFO?
Well, I didn't see it in conjunction. In other words, by the time the planes came
into view, you didn't see the two together. But my point
is, you saw our aircraft following the same trajectory. Somewhat more inland. In other words, instead of they weren't going down, they were going sort of north, south, southeast a little bit.
This is a very important declaration because...
Heading in the direction that the object must have reached after it veered inland and then went over the Palos Verdes Peninsula to be seen over San Pedro and Long Beach. These planes were heading clearly in that direction. Now, Scotty, I think you and I would agree that,
along with the bulk of our listeners, we would be derelict in duty had there not been an air response to what was presumed to be an attack on the West Coast by the Japanese. Of course we had planes in the air.
One argument I've heard from some people said, well, we didn't have night fighters in those days. Mm. Well, admittedly, night fighters were very new. But they were going to send something up there after it, even if we were just beginning, barely into night fighters.
In that same vein, let me take a couple of questions here from the VIP room. Speaking of derelict of duty, I was really derelict of duty last week, so I want to pay special attention to our folks in the V room. And one of the questions, of course, and it's the obvious, did any pilots report on that? And to the best of my knowledge, out my side of it, I have yet to see a pilot report on that.
Nor have I.
Yeah.
No.
By the way, we would love to get pilot reports. If there is anybody out there listening that is connected to this event, that perhaps had a family member that experienced it, this is still an ongoing investigation. We are still looking for witnesses, and believe it or not, witnesses do still pop up from time to time. We just found a new one the other day, as a matter of fact, right, Scotty?
Mm-hmm. I found one when I was interviewed a few weeks ago, but a month ago, for a History Channel forthcoming History Channel Ancient Aliens show on the Battle of L.A. And I was interviewed at the museum at Fort MacArthur, and one of the other people there was a guy, believe it or not, older than I am. He was 13 at the time in Beverly Hills, and he claims to have observed it over the Baldwin Hills. And his observation is very interesting. A guy named Albert. Albert's observation is very curious. He saw the object. He saw almost the scene that the Times reporter photographed, only from about 20 miles away. He was up on the sort of the upper end of Beverly Hills, where he had a view across the valley. But he also claims to have seen a flight of U.S. planes above it. Now, that's a unique observation. Now, whether he was conflating some things or not, but the guy was very, I listened to his interview. I was interviewed down there too, but I listened to his interview and then I talked to him later, and he's very coherent. He was 13 at the time, so he's a bit older than I am. But nevertheless, he swears that is what he saw. And so there were a lot of things going on. Let me emphasize, I heard a flight of planes a little after 3 heading southeast. I didn't see them. Mm-hmm. Then about 4:15, 10 minutes of 4, shortly before 4. We didn't have a clock handy, but it had to be about that point. I saw and heard a flight of planes go overhead and go off to the southeast. Mm-hmm. So, and ironically, as Frank said, the powers that be, the official Pentagon military position to this day is that there were no aircraft in the sky at all. That the whole thing was an illusion.
War jitters, triggered
by the Elwood incident 48 hours earlier, the submarine incident, the shelling of the oil installations. Well, I can testify, I would testify in court, anybody want it, that I saw and heard planes. Mm-hmm. And I saw and her, I saw but didn't hear. Oh, by the way, I should add that between explosions, between shell bursts, the object made no noise whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely silent. There was no sound coming from it.
Well, that good point, and we overlooked that. Aside from a very huge UFO, by using Bruce McAbee's math, based on the beam divergence of the known searchlights of the time and the estimated altitude by the collective reports, we put the object over 800 foot wide, silver in color, and making no noise.
No noise. The noise was the shells.
Exactly.
But not it.
Discernible noise from whatever propulsion system employed. We have to make the point of that.
Well, somebody was kind of like, well, there's a balloon might not make any noise. Yeah, but it wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds with that barrage. Right. Over the official after action report, by the way, was that 1,430 shells were fired at it. My own estimation is that that's low.
Right.
I think there may have been at least 1,500 or more than 1,500.
Right.
But 1,430 is the official. No, they nobody argues that they were firing. It's just that they were firing at an illusion, right?
Sure. And Scotty D has a question. She's asking, did any of the gunners come forward with what they saw? And I'll answer that. Unless you found something that I'm not aware of, to the best of our knowledge, no gunners that have actually either fired on the craft or were present have come forward and offered testimony. And for our listeners too, it's such a rare treat to have you on, Scotty. And people have to realize, of course, you were only 8 years old at the time. But very much like Roswell, we are losing witnesses, every month because of the date of the event. And of course, Roswell was much later in '47. So a lot of the adult witnesses to the Battle of Los Angeles, the majority of them have passed on, of course. So it's a rarity to find somebody that not only was there at the time, but of course is cognizant and can actually recount the events of that night. So this is just a big treat, and I'm so glad that we're able to do this interview.
There's another, Frank, if I may, there's another thing we haven't hit upon yet, and that you and I are both interested in, and that is the fact that one of our at least one, and possibly two, of our planes were forced down, I would say more like crash landed rather than crashed that evening. And the one that's most clearly attested occurred probably about close to 3:30, 3:25, I guess, in that vicinity, at the height of it. On South Vermont Avenue, between 180th and 185th Street, it's almost certain that a plane was forced down. The first newspaper account of this that came out in the L.A. Examiner, her L.A. Hearst morning paper, said Jap plane shot down on Vermont Avenue. And it's interesting that much of the reporter's story came apparently from a contact at the 77th Street precinct of the LAPD, and that this plane, a plane came down, but not, I don't think, crashed, because we have, Frank, you have an eyewitness that saw from the ground, he must have been a kid about not much older than I was, mm-hmm. that saw the plane be picked up, put on a flatbed truck. Am I correct?
Well, in actuality, this was a secondhand witness who had a family member. He's a young man, per se, probably in his 40s today, I think, but he had a family member that was there that said he witnessed a craft underneath the tarp as it was hauled away by the military.
And where is this?
That was in that vicinity in Vermont.
On South Vermont?
Yes.
On South Vermont, yeah.
Yes.
In other words, the plane used South Vermont as a landing strip.
Yes, and as you recall, there was some question to whether, presumably this individual thought it was a Japanese plane, but you and I had the discussion of the tail markings and markings of our aircraft at the time, or the fact he actually presumed that this had some sort of Japanese writing on it, which I find interesting because, as you will state for our listeners, that the Japanese did not use Japanese writing on their planes.
No, they used Western letters.
Exactly. And when I brought that to this person's attention, they gave them pause because they presumed the actual eyewitness presumed it was a Japanese plane with Japanese letters, and of course they have the symbol of the
right on its face. That's what he assumed was there.
Precisely.
As I understand it, there were two possible plane crashes that night. One in Hollywood somewhere, and that's the one I think you're talking about, isn't it? Whereas the one on South Vermont, as I understand it, the witness, I know it's indirect, said he saw American markings on the plane before they covered it up and hauled it off on a flatbed truck. It was an airplane. It wasn't anything bizarre, you know.
Correct.
It was an airplane. And what intrigues me is that a guy that was about a year ahead of me in high school named I ran into him online and saw a plane. This is the same guy that saw the same man that saw the, he was living in Long Beach before he moved to the South Bay, before he moved to Redondo Beach. Mm-hmm. He was I guess he must have been about nine because he'd be a year older than I was. And he saw a plane up in the sky, a plane heading northwest, and he swears it was an airplane. And he has always said that he thought that was the object they were shooting at. No, it was an American interceptor, and it was headed in the direction of what could have been South Vermont. And my hunch is that this fellow saw the plane that crashed on South Vermont crash landed a few minutes before it actually, it was heading in the right direction. It was heading northwest. So it had gone after the thing and was probably trying to get back to Mines Field, the base, which is the today LAX, LA Airport, an Army Air Base, Army Air Corps base. And there was no Air Force then. But that he was probably struggling to maintain his altitude. Why? Because he may have gotten too close to the object and have had his primitive avionics fried by whatever field was surrounding it, and was forced to land. And what happened to the pilot? Did he survive? There's no indication. But then the one in Hollywood, as I understand it, the other one, we don't have a location exactly, except somewhere in Hollywood. This is the guy, isn't it, that saw what he claimed was Japanese writing. And
I'm presuming that was Vermont, but it's been a while since I looked at
part
of the file.
Crash. There's the second possible crash.
Yeah.
That's what I understand it, Frank.
I have to look back at the file to be sure, but you can be right.
The thing that intrigues me here, that's where we get into the marking.
Right.
The American marking, airplane, the Rondelle on the fuselage and on the wings, at that point, February of 42, was a round red circle with a white star inside it.
Yes.
It's a very prominent red, the bar that from that point to this day, the bar that comes across the circle, had not come into use. That wasn't painted on our wings until May of that year by some of the Marines, and it didn't come into general use until Guadalcanal.
An excellent observation and a good point of research, I feel.
But that round red circle was unfortunately mistaken for the meatball, for the rising sun symbol, which of course is very famous on Japanese planes. And so the idea, they wanted to completely distinguish it. Well, they did. But at that point in 1942, any American interceptor who went up after this thing had that round circle, and so could have been mistaken for a Japanese plane. The Japanese, of course, are adamant, the post-war reports were that no airplane, no Japanese plane was over Southern California or indeed anywhere in the United States.
Well, in hindsight, of course, we know where the Japanese were at that time. We know that it was the I-17 that lobbed the shells in Goleta. We know all these things in the aftermath. We didn't at the time, but of course we do now. We're getting some really good questions, Scotty, from the V Room, and I'm going to throw a couple more at you here. These guys are really asking good questions, and we have one from I hope I pronounce this properly, Jelsa Gray, and Jelsa Gray asked, "Did Scott have any unusual feelings on his body, like pressure or heaviness? And let me add on to that, or did you have any psychological effects?" While we're at that type of question,
my answer is none that I can recall. Although what's curious is that, again, it seemed to hover almost directly overhead, but I have no reason to believe that it was interested in yours truly, in me.
And your mind?
No, none that she ever mentioned.
Okay.
No.
And
I had a few other sightings. So, and I did have some feeling at one point, but that's another story, maybe for another show. But nevertheless, I didn't get any feeling except curiosity, like, what is that? I have a sense of what the questioner is asking.
Yes.
The answer is no.
What comes to my mind in part of that question, of course, with the Phoenix Lights, and we did an expose on the Phoenix Lights last week and the week before, there was a psychological effects during the Phoenix Lights. So,
yes.
In fact, since that, since I'm so heavily involved in that research, I have made it a habit to ask witnesses on different cases how they felt during their particular experience, I believe it is. Right after that question, Rixio asks, could you ask how he could discern the glow? Was it sometimes not lit by searchlights, or was it part of it not lit by the lights? Could the glow somehow be seen while it was being hit or being lit by the lights?
The glow could be seen while it was being lit by the lights. It was very intense. It's sort of super intense. You could see it behind the searchlights. Yeah. Yeah. It was because the searchlights were on it steadily. They explained. You could see it glowing within the searchlight beams. Yeah.
And of course, this is pure speculation. A common occurrence that happened with the Phoenix Lights as well as Stephenville, witnesses claim to have they associated the lights with the propulsion system. For example, when I interviewed Steve Allen, he said that the white lights, when that particular UFO sped up, when it was being chased by military aircraft, the white lights turned to red. Is it your feeling that perhaps that glow may have been in conjunction with the propulsion system or perhaps just a defensive mechanism while this thing was being fired upon? I realize that's just pure speculation. But.
Yeah, it is. But my pure speculation would be yes to both.
Mm-hmm.
In both counts. Yeah, but remember, it wasn't moving fast. Now, if it had started speeding up and turned red, that'd be different. But it didn't. It was moving very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And as the CBS report said, it took so long to get their 25 miles.
Right.
It was moving very slowly. And the white light possibly was part of the propulsion system, part of the defense. I mean, it could have been both. The field surrounding it.
While the object was in your field of view, was the white light always on?
Yes.
And did it? Was there any variation?
No, not so.
So it was a constant white light emanating from the object itself, separate from the searchlights.
Separate from the searchlights. That's what I recall.
That's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Well, in the aftermath. You finally get to bed when? What, four?
Oh, I don't think I did go to bed. Nobody went to bed.
Yeah.
I think we went in and just kind of sat around and talked about it and drank some milk or something. I don't remember going back to bed at all.
What do you recall? I mean, obviously, you're only 8 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. Do you recall, particularly since now, it was just you and your mother that actually witnessed this? Nobody else went outside.
He was out doing his rounds. He came back, and we all talked about it. I mean, the older people didn't come out and see it, but my father had seen it, of course, from making his rounds.
So. And what did they say? What did they think they just witnessed?
Well, we didn't know. I mean, we thought a Japanese plane, but it was a weird Japanese plane.
Right.
The thing that occurred to a couple of people talked later, I remember saying, boy, if the Japanese have come up with a flak-resistant airplane, we got problems.
Right. And, of course, this is before UFOs or flying saucers.
Okay. Neither
term was in the vernacular of the layperson.
We didn't have any kind of a, quote, UFO. Alien craft, anything like that, a framework, flying saucer. Those words had not entered the language. They wouldn't for at least another 5 years.
In fact, it was even pre-Foo Fighter.
Yes, pre-Foo Fighter, the World War II, Europe, and Asia. There were Foo Fighters in Asia, too, by the way,
yes,
as you know.
Yes.
But most of the most famous ones were over German and may have been German. There are still some arguments about that, whether they were a German experiment that they just couldn't quite perfect in time to win the war. Anyway, whatever. All of that comes later, 45. This is 42, 1942.
Yeah.
And now there is also, maybe before we end, there are two other things I'd like to maybe mention. There is a rumor, and it's still a little shaky. A rumor that the object itself crashed into the sea off San Diego County, in northern San Diego County, maybe off of Oceanside or just a little further, that it was observed going out to sea, and the rumor is that it finally crashed into the water or crash landed in the water. The object, the 800-foot object, if that's
yes.
the water type, and that it was recovered by Navy divers. And taken aboard a ship or in tow, some kind of boat, and so that 5 years before Roswell, we may have in fact recovered an alien craft.
Right.
And that to me is very interesting because it may account for the rapid response at Roswell. In other words, they being the big they, the government, whatever, the Naval Intelligence Arm, you know, whatever. Had a pretty fair idea of what had happened at Roswell because they had this craft in their possession, and maybe two of them. If the possibility of the second craft that got over the east side of L.A. over Huntington Park and Downey, and then turned around and went northeast and crashed into the San Bernardino Mountains. That may have been the rumor there is that was recovered by the Army. So both the Army and the Navy may have had a craft, an anomalous craft, let's call it, a UFO. Of course, the term, remember, as Frank said, wasn't present at that point.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, and it might account, again, for, how rapidly the intelligence services moved in at Roswell, and it may have been a kind of like a practice alert for clamping down on information.
Well, the other part of it too, of course, if this in fact, if the powers that be are aware of more than what we know as civilian researchers, and obviously I believe they are, then that puts Roosevelt in the know in 1942,
yeah.
And it completely changes the UFO dynamic. Means that there was a faction of the government by the time what we deem is modern day ufology in 1947, there were people in the know. We had a previous president that was in the know at this point in time.
Yeah, I'll bet he didn't tell Harry. any more than he told Harry about the atomic bomb.
nobody told poor Harry anything.
No, and Harry probably found out, but probably somebody, maybe when they founded MJ-12, which I do believe existed and may still exist under whatever name, he probably got briefed by, and I think that it's very interesting to me in light of the possibility that this thing crashed in the ocean and that the Navy, is that the prominent role of the Navy in very early UFO research, right? That the Navy, that Frank Knox, for example, the Secretary of the Navy, is the one that came in and said it's all an illusion. And he set the tone.
Which is very, very interesting. And, of course, the Army denied the fact that it was Japanese, of course, but they thought it was civilian planes.
That's right.
For psychological purposes.
George Marshall and Stim. And then Knox says, no, it was an illusion. It was just war nerves. And that became the standard mantra to this day. It was nothing
but. And interestingly enough, the Navy is often overlooked. Naval intelligence is often overlooked with their involvement in ufology. And somebody, by the way, that was very that did a lot of research on the Navy end of it. In fact, sent me some of his work. Was Dr. James Harder, who is no longer with us. But he started sending me a lot of his investigative work years ago on the Navy angle, and he was hot and heavy into that.
Will he get into Admiral Hillenkoetter? Hillenkoetter?
Hillenkoetter was just the tip of the iceberg, and
he was one of the founding members of MJ.
Well, and of course, Hillenkoetter, for our listeners, was the first. Actually, he was involved in the Central Intelligence Group,
CIA,
and then
exactly.
Became the first CIA head for the Central Intelligence, which in fact was born in 1947. Ironically, in the middle of the UFO flap of the summer of 47, under Truman's watch.
Yeah. The Air Force was born then, too.
Yeah. Then bear in mind, everybody, you have to really get into the flavor of the times that all the military factions were fighting with each other. They were fighting for information. They didn't want to share. They didn't want to play with each other.
Oh, no. No. But I do, the point you're saying and that I was trying to make, we're both trying to make, is that it accounts for the fact that the Navy probably seems to have played a very important part in the very early phase of this. And it may in part be because they had either the pieces of or the whole thing. There is another rumor, and this gets way out, that bodies were found on the thing and that the bodies were Nordics. But that is so. I ran into a guy that claims that he can give me the name of the ship that picked it up, but I think we're getting off into La La Land here.
I know the guy, and yes, that is La La Land.
You know who I mean?
I certainly do, and I'm open to the notion that perhaps something unconventional fell off the coast. I have not seen anything concrete that shores
that
up.
No, I haven't.
But I do feel in terms of investigative prudence, I do believe that needs to be looked into. But
yes,
to surmise my particular opinion of the events of that night, and we're down to a couple of minutes, Scotty, is A, given, and this is one of the reasons why I feel it's necessary to frame the events of the time, the American people felt an attack was imminent. It was going to happen. It was just a matter of time. On the 23rd, we have a Japanese submarine lobbing shells at the coast. That was the prelude to the mass invasion. Then on the 24th, we have the Battle of Los Angeles. We know for certain that whatever this object was, it withstood 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds, which it was hit directly for hours. We didn't have anything then that was man-made that could withstand that type of bombardment, and we don't have anything today, period. That is the fact of the matter. It is a UFO in every sense of the word.
Oh, it is, absolutely. I think that the thing... certainly was definitely was a UFO in anybody's definition thereof. But I also think it's not impossible that they may have wounded it a little bit. I mean, at least one of those shells might have at some point when the field dropped.
I'm certainly open to that notion. Scotty, yeah, we are absolutely out of time. I cannot thank you enough for being a guest tonight. As I told you, there is this phenomenon that is connected to the Joyner Report where time is accelerated when we do this show. We experienced it again tonight. Thank you so much for being on. Would you please tell our listeners where they can find more about what's going on with Scotty Littleton? Websites, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you can visit my website, which is the website is faculty.oxy/yokatta. That was my when I was teaching. That was my UFO. My internet name. So faculty.oxy.edu/yokatta, Y-O-K-A-T-T-A. That will get you to my website.
And, of course, you have a column at the UFO Chronicles for anybody that wants to go over there and read your detailed articles on what you experienced that night. And we also have direct links to your websites and your email for anybody that wants to reach out to you. I'd like to take this opportunity to once again thank Angela for allowing me to guest host. It's always been a blast to sit in her chair. She will be back next week with a new intriguing guest, and that should be announced on Monday. And you've been listening to the Joyner Report. I'm Frank Warren for the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, WPRN-FM in New Orleans, and I'd like to wish everybody a good night. Thank you.